Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. A group tasked with diversifying the state's economy has unveiled some preliminary recommendations, including ways to improve broadband.
An absolutely key thing that has to happen: fast, reliable internet service.
Why veterans leave higher education and what the University of Wyoming is doing to help them stay.
Military, civilian life. That in itself is a culture shock.
A story about overlapping federal leases in the Powder River Basin and its impact on mineral rights.
The Wyoming Supreme Court has set a pretty strong precedent that says it doesn't have any jurisdiction over federal leases.
Should student fees be used to bring controversial speakers to the University of Wyoming campus? Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last year, the governor set up the Economically Needed Diversity Options for Wyoming Council, better known as ENDOW. After a few months of touring the state and meetings, ENDOW has developed a list of recommendations to start setting the stage for diversifying the economy. Greg Hill is the chairman of ENDOW, and he explains why ENDOW is different from past economic development efforts.
One of the things that's different is this downturn, I think, people are beginning to realize that it may be much more long-lasting than kind of the boom and bust cycles in the past. And I think there's some very structural reasons for that. One is just coal and kind of society's thinking about coal and the move in most of the power sector in the United States to switch to natural gas, I think has some long-term implications, you know, for the state of Wyoming. I think a corollary to that is that, you know, there is abundant natural gas in the United States of America, and it's very low cost. And it's in the Marcellus and, you know, plays like that. And those plays are much lower cost than Wyoming in terms of gas. So I think those two structural things about coal and cheap natural gas have made people realize that, you know, while prices may come back somewhat, we really need to start thinking about a future where we're much less dependent on that. I think the only other thing I'd add to that is that, you know, this is a 20-year plan. This isn't what are we going to do, you know, to kind of put a Band-Aid on things for the next 5 years, let's say, or whatever. This is, you know, encouragement to be bold and think, you know, think broadly and think widely about a much longer term, you know, economic development plan. A lot of the past efforts have been fairly short term focused because we've reviewed a lot of them, and this is more, you know, longer term. And I think one advantage that Wyoming has, Bob, is it's got time, you know, because it does have, you know, the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund and some other things that can get it, and the Rainy Day Fund that can get it through the lean times. It does have time to bridge itself to a more diverse economy.
Let me talk about and have you talk a little bit about some of the early stuff that you're working on. And I
you
think
bet.
Maybe that's something that people should understand. You've gone mm-hmm. after what I think the group has termed low-hanging fruit, try to address some things right away with a look long-term, knowing that you have some other recommendations to come, right?
Absolutely. So, the preliminary report, and I want to emphasize, very preliminary, and if you think about the process we went through in 2017, what the council really did was listen. Just listen very deeply to a number of constituencies in Wyoming, be they communities, be they business leaders, be they political leaders. Listen very deeply as to what they thought some of the big barriers were to further economic diversification in Wyoming. And the belief is that if we don't solve these things, the rest will be extremely difficult, you know, to make happen.
Greg Hill from Endow is visiting with us. So let's talk a little bit about it. One of the first proposals that's certainly gotten lots of attention already is the effort to improve and expand Wyoming's commercial air service. You've mm-hmm. got a price tag there of about $15 million. That's caught some people's attention right away.
We don't actually know what the number's going to be. What we wanted to do was get a reasonable placeholder in place so that people would begin to get their minds around, you know, this is going to have to be a significant investment for the state. And it's really one of those chicken or the egg things, right? Because what we heard from a lot of business leaders was, you know, we could expand our business, but one of the big problems we have is, you know, we can't get workforce here. You know, people just don't want to drive, you know, 3 or 4 hours from Denver or Billings or whatever, and so that's a big barrier for us. So how do you solve that? And I think the answer is that, you know, the state's got to, you know, put some investment into that with the belief that, you know, that's not a long-term subsidy, I'll call it. Rather, you know, that's some seed money to encourage businesses to expand and grow. And then those things become self-sufficient as those businesses expand and grow.
And then the number two seems to be one that you hear all the time. And you're going to take a broader approach to it by establishing a broadband coordinator and advisory board mm-hmm. and grant funding. That's something you see really could work in developing some alternative business?
We do, and we certainly heard that from the young entrepreneurs. An absolutely key thing that has to happen is for them to have, you know, fast, reliable internet service. Because, you know, one of the things that the internet economy's done for everybody is, you know, people can work from anywhere pretty much now, as long as you have the bandwidth, you know, to be able to conduct business, you know, virtually. And, you know, that includes the ability to do video conferencing and things like that. If you don't have adequate bandwidth, none of that's possible. So again, that was a major, major barrier that was identified by all businesses, but in particular, the kind of the young entrepreneur set, which we really want to attract a lot of those people to Wyoming and also keep the ones that we have. And what we heard from that group was, well, you know, if we had a few more things that would enable us to stay, we'd love to stay.
I'm going to mention that all these recommendations are available on the website. I want to ask you about one last thing before we let you go.
Sure.
And this is one that, in my reporting, I've found very interesting. It's trying to mm-hmm. help get the entrepreneurs going, getting the startup money. It's getting the money yeah. after you get started to get rolling. You've got some recommendations here on how you might help those people. I want to ask you just one quick question, though. Where is this? Is there any concern that this might not be a good role of government to get involved in?
Well, I think, again, you know, I think there's an absolute underlying tenet here that the government will provide some, you know, a spark. It will provide, you know, some seed capital potentially. But make no mistake about it. You know, we don't want this to be a kind of a long-term subsidy or a long-term government giveaway program. What we're trying to do is get the engines going, you know, get the rocket ship started. So it's really kind of providing that early fuel to get the rocket going. And of course, the other thing that we did in 2017 was we looked at what other states were doing. And certainly in this dimension, you know, in entrepreneurial development, the successful states are the ones that actually do provide that early rocket fuel, you know, to get things going. And so that's where the notion of the Startup Wyoming and some of the other recommendations in the report around entrepreneurship came from. And to me, this is one of the most exciting aspects of the preliminary recommendations is to actually think about how do we get this entrepreneurial engine going in Wyoming. And seed capital, and we're not talking about a lot. Most of the grants, we're talking about $5,000 to $50,000 to get going. That was seen as a major barrier that Wyoming didn't have that a lot of other states had.
Greg, we'll stay in touch on this. Good luck okay. in 2018, and thank you so much for joining us on Open Spaces.
Yeah, you bet. And I think the only thing I would add is, you know, now our work in 2018 really focuses on What additional enablers do we want to put in place? And then finally, how do we really nurture those six economic engines that we've identified in the preliminary report? So I'd encourage all your listeners to look at the report and look at that house. We call it the Economic Growth and Diversity House, and what those engines are that we see as the future diversification of Wyoming. So thank you very much.
Coming up, Wyoming's congressional delegation is on board with cuts to the Department of Interior. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Secretary Ryan Zinke is trying to implement his vision for a slimmed-down Interior Department, which is, of course, being opposed by Democrats. But correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that Wyoming lawmakers are mostly supportive of his efforts.
Last year, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke infuriated Democrats when he announced intentions to cut about one-third, or about 4,000 people, from his department. When Congress mostly rejected that plan and its funding bills, Zinke then focused more on a plan to reshape the department by moving key offices out west to places like Denver. New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Udall is dubious.
It looks to me more like a dismantling rather than a reorganization, so I'm very worried about it.
But Wyoming lawmakers think Washington is largely out of touch with the West, and they like the idea of getting D.C. bureaucrats out of their Western hair. Here's Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who supports Zinke's efforts.
I support his efforts to try to move more of the agency, move more of the agency offices, out of D.C. I know he's talked about doing that, for example, with big parts of BLM. I think that's a good thing. So I'm supportive of that.
But many Western Democrats dismiss Zinke.
I've come to the kind of painful conclusion that I think Secretary Zinke is in over his head.
That's Arizona's Raul Grijalva, who's the top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee. He says Zinke's plan to drastically slash the interior workforce doesn't mesh with reality.
At a time when we have a maintenance backlog and we're understaffed, can't fill positions, people are leaving because they don't want to work in interior anymore, his solution to the budget is to cut more.
Zinke and other secretaries will soon unveil their ideas for cost-cutting when President Trump unveils his budget for the year. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi is the Senate Budget Chair. He says the Interior Department shouldn't be immune from intense scrutiny.
I don't think there's a single agency that couldn't take a look at the number of employees they have, particularly in the District of Columbia, and make some drastic changes, eliminate a lot of duplication, and save us a lot of money.
NC doesn't understand the complaints from Western Democrats who seem to want the federal workforce who handles Western issues based in the nation's capital and not in their own backyards.
You need to have the people where they're actually serving the people that are supposed to be served, not running huge bureaucracies here.
For NC, it's also about keeping Wyoming dollars in Wyoming.
What I keep looking at is to see how much money actually makes it out into the states, out to the people that are supposed to be being served. A lot of it stops right here in D.C.
But many Western lawmakers from both parties still question why the Trump administration hasn't even submitted a nominee to head the National Park Service. While on the train under the Capitol, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says it's overdue.
I'd like to see actually have a director of the Park Service. One has not been yet named or confirmed by the United States Senate. I think that's an important move to make.
Still, Barrasso blames Democrats rather than the president, who hails from New York City.
We've had significant blockade by the Democrats on getting anyone confirmed. We just had a vote on the floor, and the vote was 98-0. But yet the Democrats made us go for a full 30 hours of cloture vote and expired time because they're delaying.
Western Democrats put the blame squarely at the Trump administration's feet, but they also say they're focused on protecting the workforce at the Interior Department rather than giving Trump another administrator set on gutting the very agency he's tasked with running. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
For her popular book, The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative, Florence Williams traveled the world talking to people who rely on nature to thrive. Along the way, she learned some things about herself and about how to cultivate awe and seek beauty in the midst of her frenetic urban life. Williams was part of Teton County Library's Mountain Story Literary Festival in Jackson. She discussed what she learned with Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington.
Welcome, Florence.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. It's great to be here.
Your book introduced me to one of my favorite new terms, which is forest bathing. Can you tell us what that means?
I learned about forest bathing when I was under assignment for Outside Magazine, and they sent me to Japan. It's called Shinrin Yoku, and that's how it translates. It's really become kind of a Japanese thing because people in Tokyo are kind of the most stressed populations on the planet. You know, they have worked the longest hours. They're really stressed out. And what researchers there have found is that even just a 15-minute stroll in a forest can really help reduce some of these markers of stress. So forest bathing, it doesn't involve, you know, disrobing necessarily. What it really means is engaging all five of your senses, paying attention, being mindful. What are you hearing? What are you feeling? How does the breeze feel against your cheek? You know, what does the moss feel like under your feet? You know, even tasting bark tea, for example. So the Japanese kind of ritualize, they'll drink bark tea as part of their, you know, 15 or 20 minutes outside. And they see these pretty profound effects.
I have to ask, how did the bark tea taste?
It tasted like bark.
Earthy.
Earthy. Yeah.
I have to say, when I finished reading your book, I actually felt, and I'm not exaggerating, a deep pull to get outside immediately.
Oh, that's great. That's just the message I want you to have.
Because the benefits are really so compelling.
Science is able now to kind of look inside people's brains and to measure physiological changes in our bodies that are kind of reflections of our nervous system. You can see how people respond differently if they're in the woods versus, say, walking in a city. Some of the effects that they're seeing, some of the benefits include a drop in blood pressure, a drop in stress hormones like cortisol. And then in kind of more extended visits to nature, scientists are measuring things like an increase in attention span and an increase in, for example, problem solving. So I structure the book really by dose. And you even see some changes in people after 1 minute of gazing up at tall trees. So it's pretty dramatic.
Were you surprised at the amount of science that's out there that is showing us nature has literal impacts on our health and well-being?
I was surprised. I mean, you know, the science has been going on for a while. I would say since the 70s, you know, psychologists really were looking pretty hard at environmental psychology, but it was harder to measure those things. And I think what's happened since then is we've seen, you know, this incredible increase in anxiety among parents, among educators, really among all of us because we feel so tethered to our devices and we know it's having an impact on us. We know we're spending more time inside. So many scientists are fascinated now by what is the antidote? What's the antidote for technological addiction? What's the antidote for sort of indoor-itis? And nature becomes a really logical place to look.
Since the book's come out, has there been any surprising reactions to the book, or do you find yourself finding audiences that you didn't expect?
When I first wrote this book, I was a little worried that, you know, no one would read it because it seemed so obvious to me. I was like, yeah, go outside. It will make you feel better. I thought, duh, everybody already knows this. You know, what am I really adding to the conversation? But it turns out that people really do like having science, you know, to sort of bolster their decisions or to help inform their decisions. And I cannot tell you how many fan letters I get all the time from people saying, wow, I read your book and now I go outside. So there are a lot of people out there who really weren't going outside. And it's really gratifying to me that, you know, I'm helping shift some of those opinions.
I'm talking with Florence Williams, author of The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. It's been a pleasure.
Time to get outside now.
Let's go for a hike.
Coming up, efforts by UW to keep military veterans in school and the value of bringing controversial speakers to the UW campus. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Back in November, conservative radio talk show host Dennis Prager spoke to a packed audience at the University of Wyoming.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm sure not all of you feel that enthusiastic about seeing me, but nevertheless.
It's true. Many students weren't enthusiastic for him to come, calling some of his talk racist and sexist. In fact, they argued university money should not be used to pay for such controversial speakers. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports for her series, I Respectfully Disagree, that's when students decided to host a public debate over that question.
Dennis Prager started his speech saying there's a crisis in America in which conservatives like him are being labeled unfairly by liberals.
What they're doing is they are completely undermining the fight against real racism, real white supremacy, real misogyny, real xenophobia, and real racism. That's the irony. They are the worst possible source of weakening of the battle against real evil by cheapening these things.
Prager said pretty soon there would be no vocabulary left for such evil. Later, though, he acknowledged there isn't always agreement on what is evil.
So if you have a uterus, you can opine about abortion. But what if you have the wrong opinion? What if you think most abortions are not moral? Did you lose your uterus? What happened there? What would they do with the non-uterus owner who identifies as a woman? They are truly transphobic.
It's comments like these that protesters say are offensive to some students, and that student funds shouldn't be spent on such speakers. But Associate Student President Ben Wetzel says the conservative student group Turning Point USA did follow the rules when they invited Prager. He says they only had to prove that the event would be, quote, educational and enriching to all students.
Whether or not you agreed with the views of Mr. Prager, if you did, it might be something that you would be interested in hearing. And if you don't agree with his views, it might be an opportunity for you to go and listen and hear more about his point of views and maybe participate in the Q&A session that was available.
But afterward, the question remained, should they have spent the $10,000 to bring such a controversial speaker? It isn't the first time the question has come up. Back in 2010, 1960s anti-war activist Bill Ayers was banned from speaking at UW after donors, politicians, and others applied pressure to drop him. That time, the student sued, forcing the university to let him come. Ayers was a liberal, visiting a conservative state. With Prager, the tables were turned. The university debate team was among those arguing to constrain the free speech of a conservative speaker. So they challenged Turning Point USA, the conservative group that invited Prager, to a public debate. The group accepted. Last month, two teams faced off in front of a standing room only crowd. Here's Turning Point's Jessica Leach.
Speech at universities, by contrast, must be regulated to attain the ends of education. Again, we ask, who determines what is educational or virtuous dialogue? At a public institution, the First Amendment encompasses all speech.
Buttle. Leach and her teammate argued that students learn a lot from the ideas that upset them the most. On the other hand, the debate team argued such opinions can truly injure already vulnerable groups. The two judges were split in who they felt won the debate. But UW debate team coach Travis Cram says the exercise was good in that both sides were forced to listen.
It's sort of the difficulty of saying there is speech out there that doesn't do anyone any good to hear. How are we going to design sort of a set of policies that allows us to kind of like make sure the worst stuff stays out without chilling the effect of a free exchange of ideas? And that, I think, is a place where maybe their eyes were open the most.
UW board trustee Michelle Sullivan was impressed by the civility of the Prager conflict. She wonders if Wyomingites learned the value of free speech from the Bill Ayers.
I think we as trustees have a responsibility to recognize that the university is a very important laboratory for young people as they begin to engage in their civil identities, to practice what it means to be a civil individual.
As far as students are concerned, ASUW President Ben Wetzel says they won't shy away from bringing more controversial speakers.
Higher education is, in my opinion, really about having difficult conversations and trying to take your biases and put them aside and look at the facts.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
The Forever GI Bill, one of the bipartisan triumphs of 2017, significantly changes education benefits for service members and veterans. It eliminates a requirement that veterans use their benefits within 15 years of active duty service. But as Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson discovers, supporting veterans in higher education is more complicated than just giving them more time.
Marty Martinez spent 29 years in the military before coming to the University of Wyoming.
Very structured environment in the military, very disciplined environment, where we know all the expectations, we know all the rules. And so coming here was probably the scariest day of my life.
He's referring to the moment in 2012 when Martinez went from being a chief warrant officer to his new civilian career as the head of UW's Veterans Service Center.
I came here expected to be the guy knowing about transition, but actually as I was working with the students, I was learning about it myself.
He discovered that around 40% of UW's veteran students were dropping out. He says UW was like most schools across the country.
There wasn't much happening for veterans in education. So they were just now starting to realize, hey, you know, these guys and gals, they have a lot of money they're coming here with in the form of a GI Bill. So how are we starting to service them? You know, what challenges are they having now that they're on a college campus? What does this transition piece mean to a veteran, and how can we be assistive to that? So really, that was the questions I walked in on.
For the last 5 years, he's been working to come up with answers, increasing tutoring, hosting more social events, and working with professors to heighten their awareness of veterans' needs. And less veterans are dropping out. Martinez estimates the loss rate is down to 30%, but he knows more could still be done to ease the transition from warrior to scholar.
I don't know, for veterans, it's just military, civilian life. That in itself is a culture shock.
That's student Zach Myers. He says his time in the Marines was defined by being a part of a team.
Even though you start as a civilian and then you join, and that changes you, and then you get so used to that when you get out, it's back to stuff you don't even remember. You're like, well, wait.
Like remembering what it feels like to be an outsider. Myers says professors often assume students are familiar with academic culture. It was hard for him to figure out even what to ask. To help build a bridge between military and academic culture, UW is piloting courses just for veterans like Myers. T.K. Stout taught the first one this past fall.
Hopefully under certificates. And then this is the hard part. Like when you get Foxtrot Golf Hotel right here, it's time to start doing some analysis and some research. So you go. So
Myers says that Professor Stout's use of military lingo is not the only thing that sets him apart from other professors.
Every time I see him just walking back and forth to class or whatever, he'll stop and talk to me, ask me about my classes and stuff. He cares. He wants to know. Like, he's the only one who stops and talks to me and will take time out of his day to do that, just even for 5 minutes.
Stout, who himself is a veteran, understands his work must happen both in and outside the classroom. He gets emotional, explaining why.
It's hard for many battle-tested combat veterans that are really hard on the outside, that they're soft on the inside. And they want to talk to another veteran. We come from a hyper-masculine society. We keep everything inside. So that's what happens when I do my work outside of the classroom.
That approach was shaped by his academic research on what he calls collaborative communication. In other words, what it takes to actually get people to listen to one another. And from his over 30 years of military service, spent stateside and in combat.
When I wore the uniform, I was a chief master sergeant. So when I retired, like, I didn't know who TK was. And I think these young uniformed service members are in the same boat.
So to help veterans find solid footing in academia, Stout's course centers around a rigorous semester-long research project. He asked them to look at their lives, find strengths and skills from their time in the military, and then justify their application in the academic world.
My name's Dorian Duga. I did 4 years active in the Marines.
During the final presentations of their projects, student Dorian Dugas tells his classmates that through his research, he'd been able to earn 23 credits at UW from coursework he'd done in the Marines. But it also inspired him to leave his military expertise in mechanics behind, opting out of engineering to pursue a new passion, geology.
I mean, it's interesting getting back into college. I mean, I've always liked learning, but I couldn't have done this at 18 or 19. I needed some Marine Corps training first and get the fun stuff out of the way. So
That comment gets a collective smirk from his classmates who, like Dugas, endured a lot of hard work in the military. But they've also worked hard figuring out how to believe in themselves now that they're in command. The hope is that a renewed sense of confidence will guide them all the way to graduation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
A coal company and an oil and gas company are stuck in legal limbo over who has superior rights on overlapping federal leases in the Powder River Basin. The case has been bandied back and forth in federal court, state court, district court. In the end, who should settle this debate? Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Cheyenne oil and gas attorney Chris Koski, who is not involved in the case, to give deeper analysis about what the controversy and potential resolution means for Wyoming.
Let's start by getting into the background on this case. Can you talk about who the players are and give a little foundation to what's going on here?
It's a case between an oil and gas lessee, Bear Energy, and a coal lessee, Peabody Energy, and along with some minor subsidiaries of Peabody. The case involves federal oil and gas lease and a federal coal lease, or various federal coal leases, both issued by the Bureau of Land Management pursuant to the authority that was delegated by the Department of the Interior.
Can you take us through the timeline of this case? It began around 2014, right? And then it went to federal court and back. Can you lay that out a little bit more?
My understanding is that Peabody originally filed suit in federal court and Bear Energy originally filed suit in state court, that those cases were at one point consolidated in federal court. The federal court determined that the particular issue was not a federal question and therefore removed the case itself to the district court of here in Wyoming.
That's a big part of the conversation, right? Neither state or federal courts can decide who should be settling the case. Then it landed in the Wyoming Supreme Court, who just released their opinion on the case. So the basic conflict, sounds like, is that these two companies were both issued leases to develop on the same land. That's pretty common, right?
Correct. It's actually relatively common for overlapping leases in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, where you do have both accessible coal resources and quite a bit of oil and gas resources in multiple formations. I'd say 99% of the time there would be some sort of business deal reached amongst the parties that would keep the dispute out of the court system.
Okay, so both sides argued in the Wyoming Supreme Court that they have priority rights on their leases. What did the Supreme Court have to say in their opinion just released?
So the Wyoming Supreme Court basically held that because those lease provisions granted authority to manage the federal minerals and administer the leases to the BLM, basically the Wyoming Supreme Court found that all decision-making for the dispute rests in the Secretary of Interior through the Bureau of Land Management. Because of that, the Wyoming Supreme Court found that the Bureau of Land Management is an indispensable party, and so it basically said that if the BLM declines to join this lawsuit, and neither of the parties can join BLM without BLM's consent due to a doctrine called sovereign immunity, that the case is going to have to be dismissed out of the Wyoming state court system, basically finding that the Wyoming state court has no authority to rule on what minerals can be produced and how the parties are to operate, and therefore, under its longtime precedent, the Wyoming Supreme Court declined to issue what we call an advisory opinion.
So the Wyoming Supreme Court is sending the case back down to a lower court now, so the BLM could theoretically get involved. What are your expectations as far as the federal agency's next actions?
Yeah, I tend to believe that the BLM's going to decline to intervene in the state court. The BLM's not going to want to make itself a party to a Wyoming state court proceeding, but I would speculate that both of the parties are going to go to the BLM and request that the BLM issue some sort of decision onto the development of the oil and gas and coal under the current leases. I would tend to believe that the BLM would issue some sort of guidance now that the BLM knows that the Wyoming courts are not going to get involved and that the federal courts have said it's not a federal question. If BLM acts, or even if it fails to act, I do believe that there is a possible administrative route through the Interior Board of Land Appeals, which would allow the parties to either force BLM to take an action or to dispute the action that BLM takes.
So it doesn't sound like the Supreme Court has set any precedent passing this down to a lower court. But if the Bureau of Land Management steps in and makes a decision, could that ease things going forward for similar conflicts?
You know, first, I would say I disagree that there's no precedent been set. The Wyoming Supreme Court has set a pretty strong precedent that says it doesn't have any jurisdiction over federal leases. Now, certainly it didn't set a precedent in interpreting the leases, but the Wyoming Supreme Court has set a pretty strong precedent as to the jurisdiction of the Wyoming Supreme Court. Second, you know, guidance from the BLM or any sort of rulemaking would certainly set precedent as to the expectations of future parties. Because if we get some sort of definitive statement from the BLM of how the BLM is going to rule in disputes such as this, there will be more clarity amongst the parties of what to expect.
Do you think this case does stand out in your mind as important and significant?
For Wyoming, I do believe it's an important case because, as we have discussed earlier, you know, greater than 60% of the minerals in the state of Wyoming are owned by the federal government. And so what the Wyoming Supreme Court has said is that on the large majority of acreage, the Wyoming Supreme Court doesn't have jurisdiction to rule on any individual oil and gas or federal coal lease terms. So it is important from the perspective of the state of Wyoming.
That was Cooper McKim speaking with Chris Koski on the significance of an ongoing mineral rights debate in Wyoming.
When we come back, Cheyenne's Capitol Corral is getting ready to go to Carnegie Hall. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. After years of going without one, the University of Wyoming has hired a new Native American program director. Right now, Native American enrollment at UW is at an all-time low, and many tribal students say that's because the campus isn't as welcoming as it could be. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Raynette Tendor to hear her own personal story of struggle as a student at UW.
Well, I knew I wanted to go to college in kindergarten, and back then I didn't really think of where that came from, but now I kind of know that goes back to my family, and my family values was education, because now that I reflect back on what I wanted to do, I wanted to be a teacher when I was in kindergarten, and it stuck my whole high school career all the way through, and I even came to UW and majored in elementary education. I graduated, and not long after, my husband was in the military and we left with him to California, and I came back to the reservation a few years after and was offered a community job within our community on the reservation. And then my whole life just took a different path at that point because I wanted to work with our own Native people and our own tribal people. And I started realizing I wanted to help them in everything. Like, I wish I could help them in every part of their life. And so I started realizing that was a passion of mine, was just helping our tribal people. And so I took a path of helping people, and I looked into that profession when I got here. One of my mentors here at UW mentioned, did you ever think of social work? And suddenly it just changed.
And was there challenges, though, the two times that you came to UW? What were some of the challenges for you when you were here?
Well, when I first got here, I was a teen mom. I came right out of high school. I became pregnant with my first son, and I was in a failed relationship, and so I left being a single mom to Laramie, and I was here in Laramie raising my son alone.
You're like 18 years
mm-hmm.
old.
I was 18 years old raising my son, and I came to Laramie to go to college, and it was just something that I had set out to do, and having my son was my motivation because he motivated me to go back to school and to give him a life that I, you know, would not be able to give him without the education, I think. Coming here, it was a culture shock for me. I came straight from the reservation here to Laramie, so I was not only, you know, right out of high school, I also was a mother of a baby and trying to be able to be successful in the university life was pretty challenging, and I experienced several challenges as far as being isolated. I isolated myself at the beginning, and I didn't want to be around other people. I didn't socialize. I went straight to class and straight home. I didn't really have anybody that really reached out to me at that time until I slowly started making friends in classes and things. And at the time, Multicultural Affairs had the advisor under them, and that was specifically per the ethnicity. So I had one, I know I had a couple people through them that started supporting me that I had met. And without those positions, I don't think I would have been successful.
And so that's kind of the role that you're now stepping
mm-hmm.
into?
Yeah, so that's the role that I am as the program advisor. I'm here to provide support, direct support and resources, and be that person for Native college kids who come to college, and even high school students who are thinking about coming to college. I'm just going to be that person that's going to guide them through this process. And already I have already assisted with this with a couple students, is when they're coming to school, say a freshman right out of high school comes to UW and meets me right away, and which is good, and that's the whole goal, is I want them to come to me first and to be here so I can be there for them from the time that it starts to continue the relationship all the way through till they graduate. But say they come in and just like me as a single mom, and they need resources for their kids, or they need schools, they need, you know, information about schools in the Laramie, or any resources within the town of Laramie or within campus that they can be useful for them as a teen mom, for their children too. So
yeah, and it seems like with the new Native American Center, mm-hmm. there's also, you know, they need to get out and kind of integrate mm-hmm. maybe, but there's also that need for joining in a community of Native American students as well.
Yes, and having the center being here, I started on finals week of the fall 2017 semester, and what the Native organization, the student organization did was have food for finals. And so that was the week that I started, and I felt like it was such a good week to start because the center was filled with all the students. They were all here de-stressing, unwinding, and maybe doing last minute printing, working on papers, editing each other's papers. And so I was able to just come in at that time and see what was all going on, and to sit down and actually visit with them and say, what do you need from me? What do you feel is needed? Or what can I do when you come back to help it be, help this process be better for you?
What did you hear? What did you start to hear from those guys?
A lot of the things were just to be there. I mean, because they just walk in, because I'm just leave my door open all the time, and they know they can just walk in. And I think I enjoyed that the most, was having them walking and knowing that my door's open.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to me about this.
Thank you.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with UW's new Native American Program Director, Raynette Tendor.
Monday, 9 members of the Cheyenne Capitol Chorale will be performing the works of Sir Carl Jenkins at the famed Carnegie Hall in New York City. Wyoming Public Radio's Annie Osborne spoke with Chorale board member Barb Boyer about the uniqueness of the trip.
Because it's a community-based choir, it is a non-audition choir. So our choir typically does not do complicated pieces. We do what the choir often refers to as fun pieces.
So how did the possibility for this more intensive performance in New York arise?
This is through a group called DCINY. It stands for Distinguished Concert Series International of New York. And DCINY is directed and run by Jonathan Griffith. They invite choirs from all over the world to sing at Carnegie for these mass choir pieces. Approximately 2006, I believe, Nancy Cornish was the choir director out at LCCC, and I was singing out at LCCC under her direction. And I found out that Mozart's Requiem was going to be performed at Carnegie Hall in 2006, and the Cantori group, which is the select choir for LCCC, had been invited to join. Nancy Cornish and Jonathan Griffith are classmates in some of their graduate study programs. My understanding is that he had heard the Cantori sing, and he invited the Cantori to sing at Carnegie Hall. And I asked Nancy if anybody could go, and she said, certainly, if you learned the piece. So I diligently started learning Mozart's Requiem, and since then, LCCC has been invited, along with Capitol Chorale, to sing at Carnegie Hall for other concerts, and I have sung there. This will be my fourth time, I believe, singing at Carnegie.
What was it like the first time singing on the stage at Carnegie Hall?
The hairs on the back of your neck stand on end. It is absolutely phenomenal. When I was waiting to get on stage for the performance, I was standing around a group of older choir members, and one of them was saying something to the effect of, yes, I've been here before, and, you know, I've done this before. And she sounded like it was old hat. And I vowed that if I ever had the opportunity to go back to Carnegie, I would never consider it to be old hat. And it never is. It is so exciting. The experience is overwhelming.
How long does the high last after that final round of applause getting off stage?
Generally, I am still high the entire next day. It takes me a couple of days to wind down from concerts like that.
Can you tell me a bit about the pieces you'll be performing for this concert?
The Armed Man, A Mass for Peace, is one of Jenkins' first major works. If you have not listened to any of Carl Jenkins' music, he is worth listening to. He also wrote a jingle for Delta Airlines
really?
At one point. Yeah. And the one thing that Jenkins does, at least in my opinion, and I did ask him this, and all he did was just kind of smile at me. So I have no idea. I think he writes for altos, and I'm an alto. And he writes parts for altos get a premier part in songs. So in The Armed Man, A Mass for Peace, this particular piece talks about how exciting it is to go to war. And the choir actually marches in place on the risers, and it sounds like an army is beginning to march down the road. And then the piece at the end repeats the piece at the very beginning. And it's an old French tune that he has modified. At the beginning, it's the song about, you know, we're going off to war and this is going to be great. And it is sung in a minor key, so it's a somber-toned song. At the end of the piece, the title of the piece is Better is Peace Than Always War. And it is sung in a major key. He celebrates peace. And that is why this piece was selected for this particular concert. It's on Martin Luther King holiday.
How have you been rehearsing so far in Cheyenne?
We've been working once or twice a week. Sheila Green, our former director, while she was still in Cheyenne, she would come to our rehearsals and play the piano for us, which was really, really helpful. She made suggestions on what our cutoffs should be, how to pronounce some of the French words, some of the rhythms that are intricate. So she helped us on all of those parts. From this point forward, we are mainly working with a CD of the work, and we are singing along to the CD, which is challenging because we don't have a director in front of us, and it's often hard to keep track of the rhythm because a director may speed things up and slow things down, and if you're not watching him or able to watch him, you can get lost in the piece pretty quickly.
What are you most looking forward to about the trip, in addition to the performance, I'm sure?
I love the rehearsals. I look forward to the rehearsals. That's some of my most favorite parts. The performances are great, but it's only one time. You only get to sing the piece once. In rehearsal, you get to sing things, you know, more often, and you have more of a one-on-one with the directors.
That sounds like an absolutely fantastic trip. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Annie Osborne with the chorale's Barb Boyer.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to listen to an individual segment, you can find it at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
There you can sign up for our podcast, listen to past shows, or send us ideas for future programs. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We invite you to follow all of our reporters on Twitter and Instagram. You can find our stories on Facebook and at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.